Meet Reed Lance Rosenthal, rancher, number one best-selling award-winning author, and unabashedly, unapologetically, on the right side of the outstanding issues of our generation. But don't try to fence him in. Sometimes his positions will surprise you, because Reed is definitely his own man, with his own opinions. You might love him, you might hate him, but you won't be able to stop listening. Step over to the right side with Reed.
This is Reed Lance Rosenthal on the Right Side Radio with KGAB AM 650 on your dial, Cheyenne, and the 21 stations of the Town Square Network serving the Intermountain West, and KFEZ FM serving Southern Colorado and Northern New Mexico. Hello, Rocky Mountains. You know, I have a very interesting gentleman that we're going to be interviewing today, and I personally think that the 10 oaths that they have taken, and you're going to learn more about them, absolutely rock. And I personally think, we're going to be talking to Mr. Stuart Rhodes about this, I personally don't think he gets much fair treatment in the press. Of course, the press is slightly jaundiced. You audience has heard my view on that before. And I believe that the concept of his group, the Oath Keepers, might be particularly apropos in today's day and age, and with what is happening, power run amok in Washington, D.C., and in some state governments, and particularly the looming so-called executive order from Mr. Obama and Mr. Biden on gun control, although Stuart's deal goes much further than that, and I think thankfully. So welcome to the show, Stuart.
Well, thank you very much. One thing I wanted to correct, though, is that our declaration is not an oath. It's a declaration of orders we will not obey as part of keeping the oath we all took when we served in the military, police, or first responders. And so we don't ask anyone to take an additional oath. It's simply to keep the oath you already took.
Exactly.
A lot of folks,
my semantic mistake. Your oath, basically, is to keep the oath.
Well, it's just we are reaffirming the oath we all swore. Like, I served as a paratrooper in the Army, and others among us currently serve or in the past served in military police capacities. And as such, we took an official oath as part of our taking our positions. And that's the oath that they are keeping, not anything else. No additional oath.
And share with the audience what that oath is.
Well, for enlisted men, it's a little bit different for enlisted or for officers. The oath for officers is simply to support and defend the Constitution against all enemies, foreign and domestic, I'll read it to you. I, name, do solemnly swear or affirm that I will support and defend the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic, and that I will bear true faith and allegiance to the same and take this obligation freely without any mental reservation or purpose of evasion, that I will well and faithfully discharge the duties of the office on which I'm about to enter. So help me God. That's the oath of a military officer. And so, you know, there's no qualification of that whatsoever. It's just simply to defend the Constitution. It's nothing about obeying anybody's orders. And the reason is because the loyalty is to the Constitution, pure and simple, and an officer has the highest duty to refuse unlawful orders. The oath of enlistment for an enlisted man is a little bit different. It says, I, you know, the name, do solemnly swear or affirm that I will support and defend the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic, that I will bear true faith and allegiance to the same, that I will obey the orders of the President of the United States and the orders of the officers appointed over me according to regulations and the Uniform Code of Military Justice. So help me God. And our political opponents like to point out that it says you will obey the orders of the President. They say, look, you're supposed to obey the orders of the President, as though that's a categorical command that you must obey everything he says. And of course not. It says according to regulations and the Uniform Code of Military Justice. And so it's qualified. It must be a lawful order. It must be lawful under the UCMJ. And it must be, of course, in accordance with the Constitution. And this is well settled. And this is what we told the Nazis in Nuremberg when they tried to say, you know, their defense was as well as just following orders. And the response given back by us to them was, is that's not a valid defense. Just following orders does not excuse your commission of war crimes. And we hung them. And the same was also true for Lieutenant Calley. That was the lieutenant involved in the My Lai massacre during Vietnam, where they killed women and children. he defended himself by saying, I was just following orders, and the response back was, that's not a valid defense, and he was convicted. And so it's really odd that our, and shameful, frankly, that our political opponents are trying to twist the oath into meaning that they should simply do whatever the president says. That's not the intent of the founders. They want the oath to be considered to be the same as the Nazi oath. In Nazi Germany, the oath is to the Führer, to obey him unconditionally and
correct,
do life for him.
Correct.
That's not how America is set up. So it's really,
right,
really sad to see all these Obama bots running around trying to make us say that, you know, if Obama says jump, we must say how high.
Yeah, well, people need to come back to the basic precept, which, to boil down an excellent description that you just gave, is no order is lawful if it's based on an unlawful motive or intent.
Well, no order is lawful if it's contrary to the Constitution. Just as the Supreme Court has said since Marbury versus Madison, any law is contrary to the Constitution is null and void from inception and it has no force. It is not law. And the same goes for an order of the president. And, you know, during the Bush years, I didn't have a problem getting liberals to see this because they didn't like Bush, and they were running around all the time saying that he was above, that he was outside the bounds of the Constitution.
No, and to your credit, you know, this is not just about Obama. You were rabid during the Bush years on several occasions with some of his orders. And you know what? I like that, because what that means is your allegiance truly is to the Constitution. And what people need to understand, and perhaps they don't, I don't know. I mean, sometimes I get frustrated trying to explain it, but all the laws in the United States flow from, in some way, shape, or form, the Constitution of the United States. And any law which is put on the books or pronunciated, like Mr. Obama's executive orders, that is contrary to the Constitution is in and of itself unlawful and does not have to be obeyed.
That's correct. You owe it no allegiance. And in fact, you owe it your duty. If you've sworn oath to defend the Constitution, you have a duty to resist it. And so, and that's the genius of the founders. They made the law. The Constitution is the supreme law of the land, not the will of a man.
And you know,
like a dictator. This is what was so, what we saw during the Bush years, is so many Republicans back then, in the name of fighting the war on terror, were advancing this argument that once the president,
yes,
is elected, he can do whatever he wants as the commander-in-chief. And like I said, you know, back then I could get liberals to see the error in that, and they opposed it, and so did I. But then when their guy got elected, now it's the exact opposite. Now you have Republicans who have rediscovered the Constitution, and you have liberals who have forgotten all about it. It's a very sad cycle. It all depends on
who's guy. And you know, to go one step further, Stuart, it's my opinion that it's not just the Constitution. Because the Constitution really, as remarkable as that document and the ancillary documents are, it is the principles that it enunciates, which are the foundation of all laws, which is really what its strength is and what its core value is to the values of America. You know, in other words, some people kind of look at me with their eyes crossed, you want us to have allegiance to, you know, three pieces of paper? No. It's the ideals ensconced in that piece of paper, the human rights ensconced in that piece of paper, the rights to liberty, prosperity, opportunity ensconced in that paper. That is really the oath that, in my opinion, the oath that the military, the police department, etc., that is what they're taking. They could almost substitute the word Constitution, although that embodies all of it, for the words values and freedom.
Well, the Constitution was the founding generation's chosen method for securing their liberty. And this is, you go back to the Declaration of Independence, look what it says there, that governments are instituted among men to secure these rights. And, you know, your rights come from God as your creator first. You're born as a human being with inalienable rights. And the whole point of government is to secure those rights. And then it says, whenever any form of government becomes destructive to these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or to abolish it and to institute new government. And that's what they did. And so first they did it through the Articles of Confederation when they separated from England. But then that's the whole point of the Constitution, is to be the method for securing our rights. That's what it is. And so I would say the true bedrock of our constitutional republic is not the Constitution, it's the Declaration of Independence.
Right.
And it's, we should remember, like in the context of right now, that with the assault on the Second Amendment and the right to bear arms, people should recall that there was no Second Amendment back on April 19, 1775. They were not taking up arms in defense of something listed on a piece of paper. They were defending their natural right of self-defense and their traditional rights as Englishmen to bear arms and to be in a public militia. And so that was a fight that they recognized and stood on, and it compelled them to take up arms, you know, way back when, before there was a Second Amendment. So your rights predate any government, predate the Constitution. The Constitution and the Bill of Rights in particular protect the rights that already existed.
Yeah, we're in a complete agreement. You know, one of the things, and I'm sure the audience has caught on to this by now, even though we're early into the interview, but you are remarkably conversant in all these things. And one of the things which I've noticed other interviewers, I mean, you've been on Fox and NBC and all sorts of national interviews, but whether the interviewers are, we'll say, rightish, particularly if they're leftish, and even if they're so-called moderates, they don't ask you about your background. I mean, you know, they kind of take delight in portraying you and folks who believe as you do as some types of kooks. And I want to give my audience a feel for really the incredible depth of, number one, your training, number two, your studies, and number two, your very varied career. So, you know, I'm astounded. Number one, folks should know that, you know, you are from Mexican and Apache Indian descent. Okay, this is not, as the liberals like to portray it, you know, the white guys, so to speak. You are of Mexican and Apache descent. You've had how many relatives in the military?
Almost all of my male relatives have served in the military. My grandpa, on both sides of the family, my great uncles all served as Marines in World War II on both sides. So, yeah.
I mean, one of your grandfathers was a gunner in a B-17 ball turret, wasn't he?
Yes.
And then you had another grandfather who served in the Battle of the Bulge, and right after high school, you joined the Army.
That's correct.
You know, and you were a paratrooper, airborne, Fort Bragg, North Carolina, and
Fort Lewis, Washington.
And Fort Lewis, Washington. And then after the Army, tell us a little bit about your educational history, because I think you should be damn proud of it, and people need to know from whence you are speaking.
Well, I mean, after the Army, I served, first of all, I worked as a concealed carry instructor, a firearms instructor in Nevada, and then I went to college there at UNLV in Las Vegas. And then once I graduated, I worked for Congressman Ron Paul for a year.
Yeah, let me interrupt for just a moment, Stuart. We're losing quality just a bit. I don't know if you moved or not, but
I think I'm okay. Can you hear me now?
It's still a little fuzzy. Yep.
I don't know what's going on.
Okay. Anyway, I interrupted. Go ahead.
No, I was just saying that I worked for Congressman Ron Paul for a year on his D.C. staff after college. And after that, then I went to law school, and I attended Yale Law School in Connecticut. And while I was at Yale, I focused on military law applied to U.S. citizens in the war on terror. And a paper I wrote on that topic, was called Solving the Puzzle of Enemy Combatant Status, that won Yale's top prize for the best paper on the Bill of Rights. And also I helped teach, I assisted teaching U.S. military history while at Yale University.
And, you know, you won several honors at Yale, correct? You graduated from Yale Law School.
The award for the best paper was the big one. And they also awarded me a small scholarship towards a book project and designated me as a Yale Research Scholar, too, which was nice. So I'm writing a book on the application of the laws of war to American people in the war on terror.
You know, you've also taught classes on the Constitution and the Bill of Rights. You've written for SWAT magazine, The Warrior, which, if people don't know, is Jerry Spence's. I'm very familiar with him, being a Wyoming resident. Jerry Spence's, one of the books that he uses, or one of the periodicals that he produces for his trial lawyers college. I mean, he's one of the one of the tops, Jews for Preservation of Firearms. You have your own blog, which is at, why don't you give folks the URL so they can take a look.
For the old blog, for my personal one?
Whichever one you want to share.
Well, oathkeepers.org is probably the best place to go currently. But if they want to look back on what I wrote during the Bush years, for example, they can go to stewart-rhodes.blogspot.com. That's S-T-E-W-A-R-T and then a little dash and R-H-O-D-E-S.blogspot.com. And that's where they can look and see what I said during the Bush years. It's an important point that I was consistent then. I don't care whether it's a Republican or a Democrat. If they violate the Constitution, I will definitely call them on it.
Good. Somebody needs to. You have 10, should we say, orders you will not obey.
Right.
In your organization, which, by the way, you're the founder of. And I'd like to go down those orders. I notice in your other national interviews, folks kind of skip to the one they want and kind of beat their chest about it because of whatever personal deal they got going. But I think all 10 deserve discussion. And particularly, not only what the, should we say, the order is that you will not obey, but the reason that you picked that particular order to be in your list of 10. And the first one is we will not obey orders to disarm the American people. That's especially apropos right now. What led you to make that number one and include it in your top 10?
Well, as we say within the text of that, the attempt to disarm the people on April 19, 1775 was the spark of open conflict in the American Revolution. And that vile attempt was an act of war, and the American people fought back and justified righteous self-defense and natural rights. Any such word today would also be an act of war against the American people and thus an act of treason. We will not make war on our own people. We will not commit treason. And so, in particular, mention that we oppose any and all further infringements on the right of people to keep and bear arms, and in particular, we oppose renewal of the misnamed assault weapons ban or the enactment of H.R. 45, which would register and track gun owners like convicted pedophiles. And so this was back in 2009 we wrote that. We knew that they would try it again. We knew that there would be another attempted assault weapons ban, and we also knew that they would attempt to do registration of gun owners. And so what's happening right now is no surprise whatsoever to us. And the reason why it's number one is because, not because we think the right to bear arms is more important than the rest of our rights. Reason number one is we consider it to be the most dangerous and most likely tripwire that would cause open conflict. Just like back at the time of the founders, they put up a lot of abuse, a long train of abuses, including the denial of jury trial, confiscation of property, warrantless searches, all kinds of abuses of their rights. But it was the attempt to disarm them. That's what the British troops were going to go do at conquered Lexington, was to confiscate weapons from the militia, from the people. It was that attempt that sparked actual fighting. And we think that's the most likely thing that will spark open conflict right now.
I happen to agree that particular attempted infringement is might just be where the rubber meets the road. And your number two, we will not obey orders to conduct warrantless searches of the American people. I think that's particularly apropos right now in terms of the NDA, et cetera. Folks, you longtime listeners, you know this. New listeners, which there are thousands of every week, thank you very much. www.ontherightsideradio.com. Please go look at the archives, because I have shows on virtually all these topics, including over the last 2 weeks on the gun control specifics that these folks who are so looking out for our welfare, right? No, this is not about gun control. This is about control. Understand the difference between the two. Please go back in the archives, listen to the specifics, and that will give you some more foundation for this show after this interview is over. So on number two, Stuart, we will not obey orders to conduct warrantless searches of the American people. I mean, there's several executive orders, in fact, some left over from Bush, where basically warrantless searches, warrantless wiretaps, warrantless email skimming is going on right now.
That's right. That's why that's there, is we knew. Under the arguments that as commander-in-chief, the president can do whatever he thinks is necessary to win the war on terror. One of them was is he can spy on the American people because this is war. It's not crime enforcement. It's not the law enforcement. That it's war, and he can surveil the battlefield. And so we were very aware of that argument back then. That's why that's there. And there was also the warrantless searching that went on during Katrina. During Hurricane Katrina, there were house-to-house searches and disarmament of peaceful gun owners that was done through those house-to-house searches. And so folks need to understand that that's exactly how they would confiscate your weapons. They would do checkpoints on the roads and look through your vehicles and confiscate guns down there. They would go house-to-house. And so they work together. This is the thing, is the protections of the Bill of Rights, the Fourth Amendment, Fifth, Sixth, all of them, and the Second, all work together. You can't isolate them from each other. They all relate. So that's why we think that, along with gun confiscation, this is the way they would do it, is through house-to-house or vehicle-to-vehicle searches. We expect that sweeping warrantless searches of homes and vehicles under some pretext will be the means used to attempt to disarm the people.
Or in the face of a so-called crisis, i.e. Katrina, the example that you used.
Sure.
And I think that order was given by the police chief in New Orleans, was it not?
Right. And therefore the mayor and the police chief both. And this is the answer we give to people who say, oh, that's never going to happen. When we say, well, look, it just happened in Katrina. Like I told Bill O'Reilly was on his show. You know, and he's like, well, that was an emergency. As though that makes it okay. It's not.
Listen, all people have to do is watch
weather.
All people have to do is watch Bloomberg in New York. Folks, let me ask you a question. If somebody's going to tell you how much soda pop you can drink, you don't think he's going to try and tell you whether or not you can have a gun? I mean, think about it.
The other absurd thing about it is that during an emergency like a hurricane is exactly when you need to be armed to protect yourself against the looters, because the police were overwhelmed. Quite a few of the police in New Orleans abandoned their posts and even went and looted themselves. And so that's when you need a gun. You know, and it's this bizarre turning on its head of the design of the founders. The founders intended the people to be armed for emergencies. You don't say, well, you can have a gun so long as there's nothing really bad going on, and then we have to go disarm you. That's exactly upside down.
You know, I recently interviewed Michael Maloof, who wrote A Nation Forsaken. It came out January 3rd, but it's about the increasing likelihood of an EMP attack of various different levels on the United States. And at the end of the book, he has survival stuff, which is really quite good. I mean, it's an excellent book. He's 30 years in the Department of Defense. And this is an apolitical guy. He really is apolitical. I mean, he's just trying to get a message out about a danger America faces. But in the back of the book, he says, I'm a concealed carry person, and of all the times that you need to be armed, it's in the event of a catastrophe like this. So it goes right back to what you just said. Okay, number three, we will not obey orders to detain American citizens as unlawful enemy combatants or to subject them to military tribunal. Tell us about that one and why it's one of the ten.
Well, this is, frankly, the two most dangerous tripwires for us are gun confiscation or the attempt to detain people and come and black bag people.
And they work in tandem.
The process. Yes.
And they work in tandem.
Absolutely. Well, this is what was going on back on April 19, 1775. Is the British troops were not just sent out to go get the guns, they were sent out to go get people. They were under orders to arrest John Hancock and Sam Adams as the two biggest patriot leaders in Massachusetts. And they were not going to get, this is not after a grand jury indictment, and they were not going to get a jury trial. This was a military detention they were going to go do, a snatch. And so that was, you know, so people need to realize in our own American history, the cause of finally taking up arms was the attempt to go grab people, too, not just the guns. And what we've seen post 9/11 is a very dangerous doctrine has emerged that claims that the president can use his powers as commander-in-chief against the American people as if the American people were a foreign enemy nation, and do the same to us here at home as he can do to a conquered nation like Iraq or Afghanistan. And the claim is that your citizenship is irrelevant, that it doesn't make a difference if you're an American citizen. They can just kill you, detain you, in military custody for the duration of the conflict or try you in front of a military tribunal without any of the procedural guarantees of the Bill of Rights, and in particular jury trial. And they claim this is somehow constitutional. It's a direct violation of first of all, Article 3, Section 2. It says that all crimes, the trial of all crimes, should be by jury. But it's in particular, the big smoking gun is the treason clause. Article 3, Section 3 states very plainly that the what must be done with an American accused of making war against his own country or aiding the enemy. That is the definition of the crime of treason. And it requires a jury trial, and it requires additional protection of two witnesses to the same overt act or confession in open court. And so the founders put in extra protections. Nowhere else in the law will you find that. They could accuse you of murder, they could accuse you of theft, and they could rely upon one witness or no witnesses. They could rely on your fingerprints being on the object or whatever. But for treason, they require two witnesses to the same overt act or your confession in open court. And the reasons the founders did that is they knew that people would be tortured. They'd seen in their own history people being tortured into confessing treason and then being executed. And they also had seen where you had secret evidence or just one witness who's a friend of the king accusing you. So that's why they put extra procedural protections. But that's all now been thrown out the window. You know, that first the Bush administration and then the Obama administration claimed that that's all of that is just normal criminal law. This is warfare. And warfare trumps all of your, you know, the power of the president as commander-in-chief in wartime trumps the Bill of Rights.
Folks, all these first three that we've talked about and some of the others that we're going to get into, if you go back in the archives and on therightsideradio.com, you will see I did a series of shows on executive orders, advertisements for guards for internment camps, very suspicious billion-dollar round purchases, 400 million of which are hollow point bullets by various agencies of the government. I did a whole series of shows on this, and you may be rolling your eyes right now going, you know, what are they? This is America. This can't happen here. Let me tell you, that's what they said in 1934 in Germany. That's what they said in all those other countries. I gave you a list in the last show where people were disarmed, then their rights were taken because they couldn't defend themselves, and then millions were killed, 56 million people since the year 1900 have been exterminated by governments immediately after they have disarmed their citizens. Think about that. It can happen anywhere. I'm sorry to interrupt, Stuart.
That's a really good point. In fact, it's good you mentioned Nazi Germany, because in Germany, this is what they did, is they, once the Nazis took over and once the Reichstag fire happened, which was the burning of their own parliament,
yes,
they blamed it on a communist, but actually it turns out the Nazis had set the fire themselves. But after that, under those emergency conditions, they set aside the normal due process for criminal defendants, and they created these special courts called people's courts, which were packed with Nazi judges. And it was basically their version of averting their normal due process and creating a second track for political opponents of the regime. And you would get railroaded through this kangaroo court and convicted and then sent off to a concentration camp. And so what's happening now is that in the name of fighting the war on terror, the U.S. government has also set up a second track. But they've used the laws of war. They say the laws of war give the president this power. And what they're ignoring and glossing over is that nowhere in our history, until 1942, when FDR detained one U.S. citizen who had joined the German army, up until then the court had overruled any such action as being unconstitutional, any detention of a U.S. citizen in military detention or trial by tribunal under the laws of war. It was done by Lincoln during the Civil War, but the Supreme Court ruled that unconstitutional, and they put the martial law genie back in the bottle, and it was never attempted again until 1942 when FDR did it. And the same court that gave FDR everything else he wanted, the New Deal court that said it was okay for him to do almost anything, including detaining, you know, over 100,000 Americans of Japanese descent, that
right.
Same court ruled in this one case of a German saboteur that his citizenship was irrelevant. What counted was what he was accused of doing. And they said because he's been accused of violating the laws of war, It is a military court that hears such accusations, not a civilian court, which is garbage, because I already told you, like I said a minute ago, the Treason Clause tells you what must be done with an American accused of making war against his own country. He requires a trial for treason. So the Supreme Court, that's where they crossed the Rubicon, was in 1942. But that decision, it's called Ex parte Quirin, has gone pretty much unnoticed until after the Twin Tower attacks in 9/11. Then the Bush administration lawyers reached back and grabbed that and said, hey,
right,
it's best to do whatever we want. And that's where it came from. And now Obama has begun to kill American citizens. He's already killed Al Waki and his teenage son. You could say they were dirtbags and they deserved it. That's not the point. The point is the president claims the power now to just kill you. Because
the point is that the erosion of any American's rights are the erosion of all Americans' rights.
And it's always done to a dirtbag first. It's always done to somebody unpopular. It's always done to a bad guy. It's never done to a saint. They start with the bad guy, they create the precedent, and then it's expanded once the precedent's in effect. So, and that's why I started Oath Keepers. I saw that we were, as early as 2002, I could see we were in a lot of trouble. And so I understood and realized that the executive branch, the judicial branch, and now with the NDAA, the legislative branch, Congress, have all jumped on this bandwagon of setting aside the Bill of Rights in the name of the War on Terror. And so I decided the only way we're going to be able to put the brakes on is to go to the guys with the guns, go to the military directly, and to the police, and encourage them to stand up and refuse to be the enforcers. Because if they don't, if they go along with unconstitutional orders to come violate our rights, Americans are going to resist, and it's going to spark a violent revolution.
You know, it brings to mind, and I use this quote often on this show, but the founder, there was a terrific quote, I believe it was by Jefferson, but, you know, he who trades security for liberty shall wind up with neither.
I think that was Franklin, actually.
Was it Franklin? But whoever said it, it's a brilliant observation. And if folks think about it, and if you think about what Stewart is saying, you think about these matters that we're talking about and how they all kind of tie in and interrelate and flow from the Constitution in the end, the pattern is always the same. Number one, a crisis either exists or is manufactured. Number two, the government says, we'll keep you safe. And then number three, they say, to keep you safe, we must do X. And everybody nods their head. It's always the same pattern. Which brings us to number four. We will not obey orders to impose martial law or a state of emergency on a state. Tell us about that one.
Well, as you just said, what they do is they convince people that because of this emergency is so bad, they must suspend the normal offenses for somebody's criminally accused. They must suspend the Constitution or impose martial law or whatever. Or look at Bill O'Reilly. Now, you would hope he would know better, but he thinks that because there's a state of emergency declared during a hurricane, that you can go confiscate guns. So there's this mindset that's infected the American culture that says, well, things are really bad, we can go ahead and set aside the Constitution. Like Lincoln, for example, he grossly violated the Constitution when he detained over 15,000 northern civilians, many of them just because they were protesting against the war or criticizing him. He would have had newspaper editors arrested and imprisoned in military detention. 15,000 northerners, not southerners who were part of the rebel army and broken away, northerners. And he had about 5,000 of them tried at military tribunal. So what he really did is he imposed a form of martial law on the north, not just against the south. And that's what we're talking about. And because of that, because, you know, you see this Lincoln worship to the point where they say, well, you know, he had to violate the Constitution to save it. And that makes it okay in their minds. I heard this argument from professors at Yale Law School and from students at Yale Law School. And it's an idea that's infected the entire political class in this country, and the legal class, that you can set aside the Constitution under a state of emergency and impose martial law. And many Republicans even think this. And so, you know, I would challenge people to go look in the Constitution. Go look for the phrase, the term martial law. I challenge you to go find it. It does not exist in the Constitution.
Or look for the phrase temporary set-aside.
there's no such thing as a suspension of the Constitution or martial law in the Constitution. The closest thing is the habeas suspension clause in Article 1, Article 1, Section 9, which says that Congress, when the public safety requires it during an invasion or an insurrection, can appeal habeas corpus or suspend habeas corpus. What all that means is they allow temporary detention pursuant to establishment or a statute established by Congress. That does not mean the president can use all the powers of war against you. He can only detain you if Congress suspends habeas corpus during an invasion or an insurrection. And that was what was done by statute during the Civil War by Congress. But Lincoln went far beyond that. He went beyond the limits set by Congress, and he tried people and had them executed. That's nothing. That's nowhere in the Constitution. And so, you know, and here's the thing about the laws of war. Under the laws of war applied to a foreign enemy, you can not just detain them and try them for violations of the laws of war in front of a tribunal. You can also just kill them. You know, that's what you can do to an enemy, right? You can kill them. You can capture them. You can detain them as a POW, or if they violated the laws of war, say, by not wearing a uniform, you can try them and have them executed. Obama now claims the authority to do all of those things to any American. What is that? That is the power of a dictator. He's asserting that the power that, as commander-in-chief, on his say-so alone, he can just point his finger at any one of us and have us killed with a predator drone strike, or detained for as long as he wants, or tried in front of his hand-picked kangaroo court. This is precisely the same kind of abuse that caused our forefathers to take up arms. You look at the Declaration of Independence. One of the abuses by the king that's listed there as causing them to declare separation from England was denial of jury trial. And they say, and one more thing they said about the king, about King George, is that he has abdicated his right to rule by making war against them. That when he set aside the protections that they were used to as English citizens.
The Magna Carta.
Right. When he set aside their right to jury trial, when he waged war against them, I'll quote it to you. He has abdicated government here by declaring us out of his protection and waging war against us. This government today is doing the exact same thing. They are claiming they can apply the laws of war to the American people as if we were Iraqis or Afghans. I see the NDAA, for example, as a declaration of war on the American people. And basically, anybody who signed that, I think they're guilty of treason.
You know, I did a whole show on the NDAA and a number of other executive orders in the 11,000 and up class, and several more that came out afterwards. And once again, I encourage people, go back into the archives on therightsideradio.com. They're all cataloged there for you. Just look at executive orders, that section, and listen to them. This is not made up hocus pocus. This is the real McCoy. Those pieces of paper exist. You can read them on the Federal Register. They've been signed by people you've elected. You need to really think about that. In number 5, we will not obey orders to invade and subjugate any state that asserts its sovereignty. Again, very apropos with these petitions for succession floating around. Whether or not they're realistic or not is besides the point. The point is the 10th Amendment and states' rights. Tell us about this one.
Well, the precedent we look back to is the example set by Thomas Jefferson and James Madison in reaction to the gross violation of the First Amendment back then, which were the Alien Sedition Acts. And so the reaction, this is where they passed a law in Congress that authorized the president to detain anybody who criticized the government. And so they had newspaper editors arrested for simply criticizing President John Adams. And Jefferson and Madison looked at each other and go, and was like, what is this? This is a direct violation of the First Amendment. It's the most blatant violation that occurred until the Civil War. That was the worst one. And their reaction to it is instructive for us. What they did is they didn't go to the Supreme Court, which was packed with Federalists. They didn't go to the federal courts. They went to the state legislatures and said, you have a duty as the state to stand up and declare this to be null and void from inception. That's what nullification means. It's nullified. It's null. It's not that they're making it null. It's already null. You're just declaring it to be null and void because it violates the Constitution. And they said to the legislatures, you have a duty to interpose yourselves between your people and the federal government when it steps across the line. You have a duty to defend your people. And so this is important. This is coming from James Madison, who was considered to be the father of the Constitution, and from Thomas Jefferson. These are very important founding fathers.
And it's also something that makes
duty and responsibility.
It's also something that ties into current times. Take a look at the border states with the laws that they're passing, basically superseding federal law on immigration. Take a look at the many states which have passed laws to protect and insulate their citizens from Obamacare. And you can go right down the list. I mean, you're
NDAA,
really seeing a rebirth of it.
Resolutions against the NDAA as well.
Yes.
You know, and there have been other versions that have passed, written by the 10th Amendment Center, Virginia, Arizona, and Michigan. So, yes, there's now a renaissance of nullification because it is the middle road. It's the peaceful way to stand up and use your state government to stand up and put the brakes on. Because if you don't, what else do you have? You know,
yes.
If you have a bunch of oath breakers in Congress who pass unconstitutional laws like they have been, like it's going out of style, what recourse do you have? If they're, you know, most of them are entrenched incumbents, like John McCain, for example, who wrote the detention provisions in the NDAA, and who now, we see right now, is working behind the scenes with the Democrats in the Senate to change the Senate rules to make it easier to cram Feinstein's assault weapons ban through the Senate. He's a turncoat and a traitor who is betraying us. And so when you have the entire Congress is infested with oath breakers, what do you do? Well, I think the answer is, as Jefferson and Madison said, the answer is the state legislatures must stand up.
Number six, we will not obey any order to blockade American cities, thus turning them into giant concentration camps. Very interesting based on some of the shows that I've done previously. Tell us about that one.
Well, that's the one we get a lot of criticism for, that people say, oh, this is ridiculous. When is this ever going to happen? Well, the first example we use is just before the American Revolution kicked off. There was a blockade of Boston, and Boston was under martial law. And when the fighting began at Lexington and Concord, and the Patriots laid siege to Boston, the citizens of Boston were not allowed to leave. They were held there. And they were tricked into turning in their arms in exchange for safe passage. And a lot of them then turned in their guns. They said, oh, if you turn in your muskets, we'll let you go. They turned their muskets in, and then they weren't let. They held them captive. They said, nope.
Gee, there's that old saying, right? He who trades security for liberty shall wind up with neither.
Right. And so, you know, as we said in our Declaration of Ten Orders, that confinement of the residents of an entire city was an act of war. Such tactics were repeated by the Nazis in the Warsaw Ghetto and by the Imperial Japanese in Nanking, et cetera, throughout history. And then we saw during Hurricane Katrina, where you had people who were told, you know, go to the stadium there, and then you'll get help there. And they went there, and then they were not allowed to leave. They were confined to that stadium, and they were not
allowed
to leave.
That's right, blockaded in the Superdome.
Right. They were sent to the Superdome, and then not allowed to leave. And so, like in our video we have on our website, our flagship 10 Orders video, we have a clip from Shepard Smith of Fox News standing on the bridge saying,
yep,
they're not allowed to leave. There's a blockade down there, police officers, and you cannot go from there to here. You know, so that's what we do not want to see. We do not want to see American citizens being confined. And when you confine a city like that, like, you know, most major cities now have these beltways around them, it doesn't take much to block off the intersections to the highway, and that now becomes a massive wall.
No, and folks, think about, let's take New Orleans. Number one, you have a martial law imposed. Number two,
not quite. It was a state of emergency.
Well, it was martial law and everything but name.
That's right.
I mean, when you restrict people's ability to live, function, move around, or bear arms, you're getting pretty damn close to martial law. So you have a city which gets blockaded. Its residents are kept inside. At the same time, they're disarmed. And at the same time, their basic lives, their day-to-day lives, are affected, controlled, and manipulated. So this has happened within the last decade. I want folks to really think about this. This is not some fairy tale. This is real, live stuff. How about number 7? We will not obey any order to force American citizens in any form of detention camps under any pretext.
And that's one that, you can look at all of these declarations as being a reflection of our Bill of Rights, most of them. They're really just statements that, look, you know, here's the reasons why you have the Second Amendment, the jury trial, all of those things were meant by the founders to prevent the abuses they had just seen under the king. That's the point. But then you can add to that the experience of the 20th century. And one of the things we saw happen during the 20th century was the use of concentration camps. And not just by the Nazis and by Stalinist Russia and the gulags, but also, unfortunately, even here in the United States, we had the internment of Japanese Americans,
right,
where you had over 100,000 American citizens detained just because they were of Japanese descent, because of their race. That happened. They were put in military bases and military detention for the duration of the war. And so it has
by a democratic administration, no less.
Yeah. That's the thing, is that whether it's a Democrat or Republican, that's not the point. The point is this has happened. And yes, it was done by the patron saint of all the progressives now, you know, FDR.
Right. Exactly.
And he did it by executive order. That's another important point. He did it with the snap of his fingers by executive order, and then Congress rubber stamped it by passing a statute to authorize it. So this was a gross violation of the rights of American citizens. Once again, if they were accused of aiding the enemy or making war against their own country, what's the proper remedy? It's a trial for treason. It's not just round them up and throw them in a military detention camp. So, you know, they weren't killed. There were some Americans who wanted to kill them. You know, luckily that didn't have enough traction to have it happen. But the point is, it happened. The mass detention of U.S. citizens happened in World War II. And the Supreme Court rubber-stamped it as being okay.
Yes,
and
the whole
case of Korematsu, it was called Korematsu. They said, well, you know, military necessity was the excuse they used, as though military necessity is anywhere in the Constitution. It's not.
Security for freedom, and you shall have neither.
Right.
Number 8.
Like you said earlier, you can look at the history. Professor Rummel from the University of Hawaii has written some really awesome books that people should read. One of them is called Death by Government, and it details what you were talking about is the massive genocide. He called it democide. When a government killed its own people, he called it democide, because they're killing the people. And as you said, usually, in almost every case, it's first they're disarmed. There's registration, compulsory registration. Then they go and disarm them, and then they intern them, and then they kill them. And
yes.
So that's why we have to have a strong, hardcore stand against all of those things. You do not disarm yourself. That means first and foremost.
By the way, if folks want to do some research, if you go back and Google and you bring up Van Jones, who was in the administration, green job czar, now works with Soros, close liaison to the White House, dropped the radical pose to achieve the radical ends, Van Jones. If you go back and see when he was an avowed and self-proclaimed communist / revolutionary, this is about 10, 12 years ago. You can still find it. It hasn't been wiped and scrubbed entirely clean. I might try and put the link on the radio site. He is asked, what do you think it's going to take to get the progressive movement, the progressive revolution, really entrenched in the United States? And his response was, and I'm taking a little out of context, you should listen to his own words, which are even more powerful, I think 25 million deaths and another 25 million in concentration camps. Those are his words.
When did he say that? I'm curious to know.
10 to 12 years ago. I actually have the clip somewhere on one of my old computers, and I've been trying to find it. But it's clear as a day. It was a video. You can watch him say the words. And, I mean, it's one of those things you have to replay 10 times because you really can't believe somebody actually said it. This is the United States.
You know, it reminds me of the statement by Bill Ayers. There was a CIA
yes,
agent who infiltrated the Weather Underground, and he, with a hidden wire on him,
yes,
I believe he recorded Bill Ayers saying much the same thing, discussing about how many millions of Americans have to be re-educated by force in
yes.
concentration camps, and how many millions of others have to be exterminated.
And if people want to track the family tree of this movement, which has now taken root in Washington, you'll see that the family tree, those branches of Mr. Ayers and Mr. Jones, come from the same trunk. Just as the branches of...
The FBI agent says, I asked, well, what is going to happen to those people we can't re-educate that are diehard capitalists? And the reply was that they had to be eliminated. And when I pursued this further, they estimated they would have to eliminate 25 million people in these re-education centers.
Ah.
And that means kill. And this is just what the FBI agent said, who's undercover.
So you have two people now high up in that movement, and shall we say directly linked to the White House and the upper echelons of the progressive movement, who have said more or less the same things.
Right.
Very interesting. Very interesting.
You can go on Daily Coast. You can go all over the web now and look at the vitriol and the horribly
yes.
Bloodthirsty statements made by leftists who want to kill us. With that one newspaper editor recently that wrote an editorial saying, hey, cold dead hands? Sounds good to me. We'll pry them out of your cold dead hands. But they're becoming much more blatant about their bloodthirsty intentions.
Well, listen, they have a terrific example right there in the White House. This is a guy who divides the country, I've talked about it many times, by race, by creed, by color, by religion, by social status, by economic status, by areas of the country, state by state, red versus blue. It's almost as if the instigation is purposeful. And I will leave
that's a really
that
good
thought.
Point, because it's interesting to see, like with the NDAA, with the
yes.
violation of the right to jury trial, there was a coalition being built, like PANDA, for example, people against the NDAA, that crossed political lines. You had both leftists who didn't like it and people on the political right who didn't like it, constitutionalists, conservatives and libertarians. And they were forming a coalition of common ground against this arbitrary detention and killing of American citizens. But now, with the gun issue, the administration and the powers that be behind them have successfully once again divided the country because leftists will eat it up, hook, line, and sinker. You must disarm all of the conservatives, all the gun owners. And so now you have a serious division. It's on the brink of civil war. And so it could be that we're being manipulated, that both sides are being manipulated.
I think the whole thing is manipulation. I think the whole thing is part of a plan. I think it's brilliant. I think it's being brilliantly implemented. And I have long said that, long before other commentators anywhere said it. This is not ineptitude. This is not an experience. This is a plan. It's brilliant. It's intentional. Which brings
right.
us to
I think it's
which
the look in their face. I think the gun issue in particular.
Yes.
Whatever someone might have gone along with before, when you are coming to take their guns, it's a personal affront. It's much like the Stamp Act in the time of the revolution, leading up to the revolution. The Stamp Act was something that everyone felt because everyone sent letters and paid bills and used paper, and they had to put a government stamp on every one of them and pay a tax since they were constantly reminded of this affront and they were personally harmed by it. And this is kind of the same way. When you're coming to take someone's gun or telling them they must go down and register like a sex offender and get photographed and fingerprinted, that affects them now. It's not some future hypothetical, I might get blackbagged in the middle of the night, or maybe they're watching my emails. This is you are being affected now.
And it affects the safety and security of their family.
Sure. They're gonna directly affect your ability. Well, here's the thing about this ban that Feinstein's proposing. She wants registration. She wants you to go down to a police station and register. And then she's also saying that, you can keep this gun for now, but when you die, it dies. So what she's really
right.
telling you is that your culture will die with you. You will not be able to pass that firearm down to your children. And, of course, if she gets her way, all it takes is one more tragedy. And then they'll say, well, now that we've all registered them, we know where they are, now you got to turn them in.
Or somebody will run amok with a revolver, and suddenly the revolvers will be the object of attention.
Right. Well, a sniper rifle.
You know, Stuart.
Bolt-action rifle, and they'll call it a sniper rifle. And
exactly.
And the thing is, every hunter out there needs to understand that they intend to crush your culture. They do not want you to have a right to hunt. They don't want you to have any firearms. Don't think you're safe. You're not.
No. It's further than that. They don't want you to have any means to resist their control.
Oh yeah, of course.
It's a much bigger picture.
Yeah,
so we're actually running out of time.
I want to give the message to the there are now hunters running around saying, well, no one needs an AR-15 to hunt.
Right.
It's not about hunting in the first place. It's about the military capacity of the American people. And like you said, they don't want you to be able to resist. But the hunters, even if all they care about is hunting, they need to understand that they're not going to be safe either.
That's right. I mean, it's just like people thinking foolishly that only the rich are going to be taxed. I guess everybody hasn't looked at their paycheck in the last 2 weeks. Looks like to me everybody got taxed.
Right.
Number 8 is we will not obey orders to assist or support the use of any foreign troops on U.S. soil. I'm going to have you back on, Stuart, because I really want to finish this up. That one is particularly interesting to me, given the joint exercises with 20,000 Russian commandos on American soil right now. I find that really disturbing. And then number 9 is we will not obey any orders to confiscate the property of the American people, including food and other essential supplies. Hey, folks, go back to my show, or don't even go to my show. Look up the NDAA, the executive order, which talks about food, fuel, farm tractors, you name it. Everything you need to live, eat, and breathe on a given day comes under the control of this government with a swipe of the pen. Don't believe me? Read it for yourself. Number 10, we will not obey any orders which infringe on the right of the people to free speech, to peaceably assemble, and to petition their government for redress of grievances. That's almost directly out of the Founding Fathers. I want to ask you a question, Stuart, as we're wrapping up. First of all, how many folks roughly are in your organization have sworn to not obey these 10 orders?
We have approximately 22,000 dues-paying members, but they're really just the tip of an iceberg, because for every single police officer or current serving military or veteran that joins, there are thousands of others who feel the same way. And that's how we like it. It's necessary to have that visible tip that we can say, look, you know, really, they are in the ranks, but it's also good to have people who are not official members who feel the same way, because they're hard to purge. They can't just go and purge out all the oath keepers and be done with us. There's many more out there who feel exactly the same way. And I know, I talk to active duty all the time, and they'll tell me that, hey, my whole platoon feels the same way, even though I'm the only member, the rest of the guys agree. So that's what's really nice about it.
You know, one of the things I want to talk to you about when I have you back on is the National Guard and which way push comes to pull, certain state National Guards might go, and all sorts of, I mean, this is a subject really that bears lots more discussion. Before we go, would you please give them the site of the Oath Keepers again, please, so that people can take a look.
Oathkeepers.org.
Oathkeepers.org, folks. Some terrific videos on there, some further explanation of these 10 orders that the Oath Keepers will not invoke or enforce. And let me ask one last question, Stuart, before I let you go, and we run out of time here. Is the Oath Keepers only for folks who are veterans in active military or in law enforcement? I mean, can other people get involved or somehow support you?
Yes, they can join as associate members.
Okay.
They can, even if they've never taken an oath in an official capacity, they can join as an associate. And the other way they can help us also is we have a billboard campaign to put billboards outside of every major base in America. And so they can check that out. And if they want to go out and sponsor a billboard, you guys get the billboard outside of a major base, contact us. We'll give you the artwork. So, you know, we'd be more than happy to have their help with that too.
Terrific. Listen, thanks so much for this hour. It has been fascinating. I want to have you back on because we barely dented it. You have yourself a great New Year's. Keep doing the great stuff that you're doing, and I will try and get the word out.
Thank you very much.
You bet. This is Reed Lance Rosenthal on the right side, folks. I hope this opened your eyes and you're thinking just a bit. KGAB AM 650 on your dial, Cheyenne, and the Town Square Network serving the Intermountain West, and KFEZ FM Northern Colorado, Southern Colorado, and I'm still thinking about this interview, to be honest with you, folks. I'm a little distracted. Southern Colorado and Northern New Mexico. We will see you next week.
For more information about Reed and his work, please go to ontherightsideradio.com. There you can also click to purchase the first two volumes of his number one best-selling historical Western series, Threads West, An American Saga, and Maps of Fate. And now the first volume of his new nonfiction series, Land for Love and Money, is available everywhere, or go to landforloveandmoney.com. That's Land for Love and Money. We'd also like to remind you that if you've missed any shows, you can go to the show archives on Reed's ontherightsideradio.com webpage. We look forward to seeing you again next week for another episode of Reed Lance Rosenthal on the Right Side.